Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 12, 2003. From the WTO ministerial meetings in Cancun, Mexico, I'm Vipa Fernandez. Thousands demonstrate in support of Palestinian President Yasser Arafat as Israel's parliament decides to expel him. A federal appeals court has rejected the Bush administration's request to keep Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force documents confidential. And at the WTO meetings in Cancun, poor countries call for access to cheaper generic drugs. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, a U.S. House committee considered the struggles of African Americans in D.C. However, the rest of Congress was out of session, and most members of Congress left for the weekend. But that didn't stop Government Reform Committee Chair Tom Davis of Virginia or member Eleanor Holmes Norton of D.C. from continuing. The panelists giving testimony, whether they represented a religious organization, a think tank, or big business, all came to the same conclusion. Lack of jobs coupled with racism is at the heart of the cycle that severely impairs most black men from rising in U.S. society and harms black families. George Stark, chair of the D.C. Black Men and Boys Commission, says that mentoring and training means little unless meaningful work is available.
I think the issue of leadership on an individual level, which would be mentorship, but at the end of the day, it does come back to jobs and the ability to make money and build a family.
Workers who crossed the picket lines at Yale University have joined the strikers, now in their third week. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
About 15 of 60 Latino workers who had been recruited by a temporary employment agency hired by the Yale administration walked off the job this morning and joined strikers on the picket lines. The workers were being paid $10.60 an hour to clean toilets and wash floors. They said they were given impossible workloads and mistreated by their supervisors, who screamed at them and called them names. Angelica Ponte, one of those who walked out, said even though she knows it will be hard to get another job,
I'd rather be here and support something I believe in than work for somebody and be a slave, where they don't respect me, they disrespect me.
The union will pay those who walked out $250 a week in strike benefits. The action followed criticism earlier this week from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus that Yale has hired few Hispanic workers until the strike. Thousands of workers and students from around the country are expected for a major rally here tomorrow. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
Indian farmers destroyed a Monsanto greenhouse in a protest against genetically modified organisms. Miranda Kennedy reports from New Delhi.
The farmers targeted a research station in the capital city of India's largely agrarian southern state of Karnataka. Monsanto India said that two Monsanto workers were injured and one greenhouse was destroyed in the action. At least 29 farmers were arrested. Monsanto holds a monopoly on the sale of genetically modified cotton seeds in India, but their use is highly controversial among farmers here. Only 6 of 29 Indian states allow them to be sold. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New Delhi.
The United Nations Nuclear Agency has set the stage for a resolution against Iran, worrying some that another conflict is imminent. Heather Risby reports from the UN.
At the Vienna meeting of the Atomic Energy Agency, the Iranian delegation walked out in protest, alleging that the resolution for deadline was part of the U.S. designs to reshape the entire Middle East region. Submitted by Australia, Canada, and Japan, the resolution calls on Iran to provide speedy cooperation with the U.N. agency. Passed without any vote, it does not pose any immediate threat to Tehran, but diplomats believe the Security Council could impose sanctions if Iran failed to remove doubts about its nuclear program. The Iranian government says its nuclear program is meant for generating electricity and that it has nothing to do with the nuclear weapons manufacturing. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
A federal judge charged the D.C. police wrongfully arrested 400 people protesting at last year's International Monetary Fund meeting and ordered the release of confirming reports done by district officials. Kevin Little reports from D.C.
Attorneys from four lawsuits are seeking investigative reports from the Washington, D.C. police. The reports stem from an IMF protest held last year where almost 400 people were arrested. U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan ordered D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams and Police Chief Charles Ramsey to release the reports by noon today. The reports, which had not been released to the public, are said to verify the accusations. Mara Verhaden Hilliard, attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice, said the acts by the police last September were a complete violation of free speech.
This was done as an intentional effort to stop people from expressing their political opposition to the administration's war in Iraq as well as against IMF and World Bank.
The reports will be in the hands of the judge and attorneys early this afternoon and will be posted on the Partnership for Civil Justice website today. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Kevin Little.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, thousands of Palestinians demonstrated after Friday's prayers in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. In Jerusalem, clashes erupted between Palestinians with stones and the Israeli police, who retaliated with tear gas and rubber bullets. The protest sparked by the Israeli parliament's decision to expel Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the decision to throw Arafat out of the country is only, quote, in principle. The Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz initially advocated either killing or expelling Arafat, and Israeli Defense Forces even began preparing for such a plan. The parliament says their decision comes after this week's suicide bombings, which Israel blames on Arafat's Fatah group. Meanwhile, the Al-Aqsa Brigades said a series of suicide attacks will strike all Israeli cities in the case that the Israeli army tries to, quote, touch the Palestinian president. Awad Duabes has more from Ramallah, where Palestinians are maintaining a vigil at Arafat's compound.
Thousands of Palestinians gathered last night in the Muqata'a, the compound of Yasser Arafat, just after the Israeli security cabinet announced its decision to expel the Palestinian president Yasser Arafat, declaring that Arafat is an obstacle to any reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. Palestinian demonstrators denounced the decision and pledged to stand by Abu Ammar, the revolution name of Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat, who looked in good health, saluted the demonstrators and urged them to give themselves to Palestine and not to him. Arafat affirmed that no one can throw him away and announced that Israelis have to kill him before he could be exiled. Palestinians at the compound looked united in what now being called a new intifada. Saleh Rafat, Secretary General of Palestinian Democratic Party, told Free Speech Radio News after a meeting with Arafat that Arafat will resist any Israeli efforts to throw him out of the country.
President Arafat is saying that no one can expel him, and the Palestinian people are affirming that President Arafat will resist with his leaders, counselors, and guards here at Al-Muqata. And he will fight with his guards and the Palestinian people. Everybody will fight to defend the president and the Palestinian people.
The Israeli decision, according to both the Palestinian population and political observers, is an implementation of an Israeli plan that aims at destroying the Palestinian Authority. According to the Israeli Daily, shortly after the decision to expel Arafat, U.S. officials contacted Israeli officials to block sending Arafat into exile, but endorsed a measure to remove Arafat eventually. Mustafa Barghouthi, head of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees, said these plans will fail.
I think Israel is trying from one side to blackmail Arafat, which will not succeed, and then on the other side prepare the ground for the possibility of his removal, which will be a disaster because it will mean the removal of the whole Palestinian Authority. And I think this is what Sharon was planning to. He wants to take revenge from Oslo, he wants to take revenge from all Palestinians and Israelis who were involved in the peace process, and he wants to remove the possibility of a potential for a Palestinian state and thus for a peaceful resolution, but he will fail.
In Jenin, a communique was distributed by the armed branch of Yasser Arafat Fatah faction. Al-Aqsa Brigade said a series of suicide attacks will strike all Israeli cities in case Israeli army tried to touch the Palestinian president. Ruba, who works for the Health Development Information Program in Ramallah, said she will stay there as long as it takes to protect the Palestinian struggle.
I'm coming here to support Abu Ammar because what is going on really terrible. The Israeli didn't understand what the Palestinian people, government is asking for to end the occupation.
Arafat met today with his newly appointed Security Council, the entity which now combines all of the Palestinian security services. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority is examining the possibility to form a united leadership, and the new appointed Prime Minister, Ahmed Qreya, is still in negotiations to form his new government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ahmad Abbas in Ramallah.
A federal appeals court has rejected the Bush administration's request to keep Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force documents confidential. The lawsuit is by two advocacy groups who say the public has a right to know who participated in the group that Cheney formed 2 years ago to develop a national energy policy. Environmentalists suspect the task force was compromised of energy industry executives who would support traditional energy production and profits over environmental considerations. Also, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is refusing to produce records on a Halliburton subsidiary that received sole-source contracts in Iraq. Mitch Jeserich has more from Washington.
Contracts awarded to the Halliburton Corporation could be as much as $7 billion to restore Iraqi oil production and provide services to the U.S. military in the occupied country. A portion of that money will go to Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root. The Pentagon has denied the conservative advocacy group Judicial Watch a Freedom of Information request on records pertaining to how Halliburton received those contracts without going through a competitive bid process. Tom Fitton is the president of Judicial Watch.
It's not to say that Halliburton is incompetent or isn't the best company, but it has been associated with the vice president. It used to be run by the vice president. It's being investigated by the SEC. And people want to be sure that a politically connected company such as Halliburton was awarded the contract properly. The Pentagon's refused to divulge the documents to help us be assured of that point.
Vice President Dick Cheney was Halliburton's chairperson for 5 years until he stepped down to run with President George Bush for office. Cheney has made a handsome sum in the oil and energy industry and even now receives almost $200,000 a year from Halliburton, which is much more than he receives for being the vice president. But Cheney received a setback on Thursday when an appellate court ruled his energy task force couldn't keep its documents confidential from the public. It is the fifth straight ruling against Cheney and the task force. Both Judicial Watch and the Sierra Club have sued the administration for the release of documents to reveal who comprised the task force that helped develop a national energy policy. The Bush administration has already said that Ken Lay, former chairperson of Enron, was a member of the task force, and Sanjay Narayan, an attorney with the Sierra Club, says the public has the right to know who else is influencing the country's energy policy.
The administration right now is in the process of pushing in the Senate a really inefficient, dangerous, and polluting energy plan, and Congress nor the public can assess that plan unless they know where it came from. In this case, the administration has here and elsewhere rolled out the red carpet for big industry and for the energy corporations in this case while keeping the public out. The process can't work while the administration is taking that policy.
Republican congressional leaders still vow to have an energy bill on the president's desk by early October. The Republican chairs of the conference committee working on the bill, Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, who is a supporter of nuclear energy, and Congressmember Billy Tozzin of Louisiana, who is a supporter of increased oil drilling, will write a final energy bill in a closed-door session. Catherine Morrison is with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
But rather than actually having an open debate in the conference committee where all the issues get discussed about what's wrong and right with this bill, they're just going to try to draft a bill and then get reactions as to whether or not that's the right thing to do. It's unclear exactly how this process is going to work, but they don't seem to have any real guidelines in terms of how or whether they even have to accept the comments and criticisms that they will receive from other parties about their drafts. And the drafting process and whether they consider these comments will all take place in their offices, not in a public hearing process.
Most Republican lawmakers support the House version that includes tax breaks for energy companies, increased fossil fuel exploration on both coasts of the country, and oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Democratic lawmakers are encouraging the Republicans to strip the energy bill of the controversial proposals and then to pass a bill requiring the energy industry to meet mandatory reliability standards to prevent future power outages. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezrich in Washington.
Leaders of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, met with delegates from China and Japan, South Korea and Europe in Indonesia for the 24th annual four-day conference, which began Monday. High on the agenda was the issue of international terrorism and migrant workers. Officials attending the meetings were placed on a state of alert due to the recent violence in Indonesia. Meanwhile, migrant workers in Korea hope that the ASEAN meetings will bring relief to those facing deportation. The landmark employment permit system for foreigners is set to legalize hundreds of thousands of undocumented employees starting next month, but labor activists and migrant workers remain doubtful about the supposedly worker-friendly program. From Seoul, Yongji Khan has more.
The Employment Permit System, or EPS, calls for migrants working in Korea illegally for less than 3 years to register to receive a 2-year work visa. For some, the EPS is seen as a victory for migrant workers' rights. Shim Jung-in, a labor consultant for Friends of Asia, the Migrant Workers' Solidarity Organization, believes that promoting human rights for migrant workers is important.
그래도 이제 3년 미만 된 사람들은
If with less than 3 years of legal stay, migrant workers could be legalized, they would be able to work safely as long as 2 years. Those legalized by the empowerment permit system could receive all the protection from Korean labor law and right. In that sense, their situations and positions as workers would be much more stable. Their working conditions would be really improved.
Critics of the EPS believe that allowing provisions for one category of workers as opposed to another is problematic. They say illegal workers past the 4 years have no protection, even though they are the ones who fought for the employment permit system. Now those workers are facing a November 15th deadline to leave Korea. 28-year-old Jashim is from Bangladesh. He has lived in Korea for 6 years and speaks Korean fluently. His brother, who has lived in Korea for 3 years, is eligible under EPS standards, but Jashim is being asked to return to his country.
No, I'm not going to report myself. According to the law, because my stay is more than 4 years, I can't register. Korean government told us to go home. They want to kick us off. Frankly speaking, when I heard more than 4 years of illegal stay workers can't register, I felt very strange, and I didn't know what to do. Did I do so wrong to stay more than 4 years? I can't understand. What can I do now? How can I solve this problem? It seems there is no way, no help.
Samuel Tete is from Ghana, Africa. He is 30 years old and he has his wife, 3 children and parents in Ghana.
Back home from our hometown, Ghana, we don't have any job over there. So we are here, travel here to come and work to get some money to go and take care of our family. But the government and the politics people say we should go back. We should go back. We should leave this country and go back. That we don't know. We don't know what is going on. So we are just praying for these people, for God to change their mind, even they can take something better for us. Because of that, we are here.
Foreign workers have paid about $10,000 to the agency for commission to work in Korea. Many sold their houses, lands, or borrowed money for the commission. Earning less than $1,000 a month means that for the first 2 years, many workers spend their earnings paying the commission rather than saving for families back home. And now they are being asked to leave. However, they can't leave. They paid too much to come to Korea. Some even risked their lives. They can't go back empty-handed. Like Jashim, if they leave Korea, then they may never come back.
집에다가 전화 걸었을 때, 집에 오라고 못 갔을 때.
When I call home, my parents ask me to come and visit, but I can't. It is really difficult. My parents don't know my situation in Korea. They tell me even though I like Korea very much, please come home sometimes. But I can't. It's so hard.
As for now, migrant workers ineligible for the EPS face a November deadline to leave or risk deportation. Many migrant workers still say they would fight against the government again. And also many migrant workers' solidarity organizations would be on their side. They believe one day they could achieve more human rights improvement for migrant workers, just as their long fight made the present EPS possible. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eunji Kang in Seoul.
Advanced ID Corporation, a pioneer in the radio frequency identification or RFID market, today announced that it has completed a successful field test of its new RFID tags and readers at one of Canada's largest beef processing plants. This is a new level of technology. The Electronic Product Code, or EPC network, will be unveiled as an executive symposium in Chicago. RFID microchips are embedded in products, and a radio antenna gets information to and from the chips. The EPC network is a way for RFID devices from anywhere to communicate with each other on a single common platform. RFID technology is touted as an inventory control and anti-theft measure. Some call it the next generation barcode. Others call it an invasion of privacy. Kelly Aramaris has this report.
The EPC network was developed by the Auto ID Center, which is headquartered at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The center's goal, as stated on its website, is to create, quote, an open global network that can identify anything, anywhere, automatically, unquote. Some people consider this technology to be the next generation barcode. Others call it an invasion of privacy. Kevin Ashton, executive director of the Auto ID Center, explained the center's stand on consumer privacy.
We are opposed to mandatory linking of personal identity information to object identity information.
California State Senator Deborah Bowen, who chairs a committee on new technologies, recently held a hearing on RFID. The senator herself uses RFID technology in the form of microchips implanted in her cats as part of a pet tracking service.
The technology itself is neutral if it can be used to avoid bacterial contamination of food. That will be a positive thing. But if your razor blade is sending information about how often you shave back to the manufacturer, I don't think most people are going to be interested in that.
Ashton was unable to attend Bowen's hearing. Instead, he sent a written statement advocating the use of a kill command that would deactivate the chips forever at the point of purchase. But Catherine Albrecht, director of Caspian, Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering, doesn't have confidence that a kill command would actually be used.
I had lunch at one of these Auto ID Center things. I sat next to a guy at the banquet lunch who turned to me and he said, oh, you're a consumer expert. So everybody keeps telling us consumers are going to demand kill switches. He said, but you and I both know that, you know, we in the industry don't want that. He said, so tell me as a consumer expert, first of all, would they even find out if we didn't kill the tags?
Consumers might not even know when RFID tags are present. The Japanese firm FEC has created the world's smallest RFID microchip. It's about the size of a period at the end of a sentence. It can be manufactured for less than 10 cents and embedded into currency, animals, children, bullets, credit cards, or anything else someone might want to identify. The Malaysian government has recently purchased the rights to the Japanese chip and will eventually begin manufacturing them at a state-owned plant. The Malaysian Prime Minister called the tiny chip a boost to the global anti-terror war. According to Wired magazine, some of the biggest food companies and retailers in the U.S., including Procter & Gamble, Walmart, and Johnson & Johnson, have asked the Department of Homeland Security to declare RFID an anti-terrorism technology. When asked if the retailing industry would abandon the technology if the government ever co-opted RFID to track the populace, Kevin Ashton of the Auto ID Center said,
I can't see any reason for people to abandon the technology. I think the scenarios that are being described around Homeland Security and various other things are somewhat fanciful and unrealistic. It's not terribly useful for finding terrorists. It can be quite useful for making sure the cancer medication you buy from the pharmacy isn't fake. But in terms of identifying malicious behavior or anything else, it's actually not terribly useful.
The Caspian's Catherine Albrecht says that the fact that every RFID tag would have a unique number could spell trouble for political dissenters.
Using this new technology, when you went and bought a six-pack of Coke and you scanned a credit card or an ATM card or a loyalty card, that can of Coke and each of the identifying numbers with it would essentially be registered to you and to, you know, your name in a database. Let's say you laid down a mat on the way to the protest site. Law enforcement laid that down. Everyone stepping on that mat, if they had an RFID device in their shoe, would be identified. quickly and easily as they walked in. You could even tell when they walked out, how long they'd been there.
Caspian plans to protest the EPC rollout in Chicago. More information on the protest is available at www.spychips.com. The Auto ID Center's website is autoidcenter.com. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
The World Trade Organization's fifth ministerial meetings in Cancun, Mexico, where almost 150 nations have gathered to hash out agreements on global trade, ran into significant roadblocks today. The European Union and Japan have been trying to start new talks on opening up national markets in financial investment and government procurement to multinational corporations, but more than 70 developing countries, led by Malaysia, announced they would block any such move. Also, a newly formed group of 21 developing countries, such as Brazil and India, have brought pressure on the US, the European Union, and Japan to remove all subsidies to their farmers. The more powerful countries are now trying to exploit differences between the group's members. Meanwhile, activists have continued to protest against the trade negotiations by unfurling banners outside the convention center and staging unannounced protests at the press conference inside the building. And as Prothap Chatterjee and Dan Jaffe report, some of those protests have shed light on the controversy and conflict between poorer countries and the pharmaceutical industry.
In the days preceding the WTO meetings, an agreement was reached by trade diplomats that allows countries facing public health crises such as HIV/AIDS, malaria, or tuberculosis to import the needed medicines from other countries that are authorized to manufacture cheaper generic versions of patented drugs. Some WTO members hailed this agreement as a breakthrough and claimed it proved that the WTO did indeed work in the interests of the world's poor. Yet Sheila Kwamara Mshambe, a member of the Ugandan delegation and a member of the East African Parliament, says the agreement reached just before Cancun makes it impossible for any nation to produce drugs for humanitarian purposes.
By patenting the drugs, it is becoming very, very difficult even to handle a disease which was handled in the past, such as malaria and tuberculosis. So these drugs are becoming resistant in our situation, and we feel that unless something is done, something is done in the interest of these developing countries. Some ministers and secretaries of trade are saying developing countries are asking for too much. But I think when you see your child dying, when you see your witness, your family dwindling, everybody dying away, I think it's not asking too much just to say we are human beings, we would want to see our people living.
The world's 10 leading pharmaceutical labs, including Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, and Johnson & Johnson, together represent 58.4% of the global medications market, and together move some $322 billion a year. Another top 10 corporation, Eli Lilly, argues that without the patent protections, the company would not be able to recoup the nearly $500 million it spends each year on discovering and developing new medicines. Gawain Kripke of Oxfam disagrees.
The reason drug prices are high is because pharmaceutical companies can charge a lot. And the reason they can charge a lot is because the patent system provides a monopoly. When you have a monopoly, you can charge whatever price you want. And when people's lives are at stake, people will pay whatever they can. Except many people are at risk of losing their lives with HIV and malaria, and they simply don't have the money to pay, and so they will die. So that's the solution we're trying to find.
Activists charge that the U.S. additions to the text of the agreement make an already flawed document even more unworkable. The new restrictions include limits on the countries that can obtain exported medicines, would require costly manufacturing processes to differentiate pill size, shape, and color from brand name products, and would disqualify any generic producer unwilling to operate on a not-for-profit basis. Wrangling over a new drug access agreement continues at this time, and it's unclear whether any new agreements will be reached before WTO delegates head home on Monday. In Cancun, I'm Dan Jaffe for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to FSRN. I'm Deepa Fernandez.